From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When you use a disposable diaper, some scientists might tell you the plastic in that diaper actually stays in the environment for hundreds of years. The plastic bag you brought home from the grocery store? Estimates vary, but some put the number of years it takes to decompose as high as 1,000. Whether those numbers are accurate or whether more research needs to be done doesn't change what we know about how plastics are showing up in oceans all over the world, and not only harming marine life, but becoming part of the human food chain. Today, we're going to learn more about how and where plastics are showing up, and what some local people are doing to change not only the way we think about plastics, but how and how much we use them. Bonnie Monteleone works at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where she is a plastic marine debris research and lab assistant. Bonnie Monteleone, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is education curator at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about the effect of plastics on marine life or plastics in the ocean, send it to coastline@whqr.org. A bit later in the program, we'll open the phone lines. And we've already gotten some emails with questions. We'll get to those hopefully in this first segment. But Bonnie Monteleone, let's start with you. Many people have heard about a garbage patch in the ocean full of plastic. And we'll go into detail also as the discussion goes on in terms of where these patches are, because there's more than one. But is the plastic that we're seeing in the oceans confined to these garbage patches?
Sadly, it's not. I mean, the reality is that it doesn't matter where you live. If you live on a mountain, rivers lead to rivers that lead to the ocean. And there's an estimate of 8 to 12 tons of plastic are entering our ocean from runoff annually, and that's globally.
And is this plastic confined then to a certain area? Is it concentrated in a certain part of the world?
Yeah, so the oceans have their own circulation systems just like our bodies. And so these circulation systems consist of currents, wind, weather. And so the debris that's coming off of the rivers then gets caught up in the currents that circle around different areas of oceans, and particular five. So they're called gyres. And those circulation systems typically have a becalmed area in the center. And so those plastic items that end up in our waterways end up in the currents and then eventually lead to these centers where the high pressure system is. And that's how these garbage patches are formed.
Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, why is the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher involved in teaching people about plastics in the ocean? What's the scope of the problem from where you sit?
Within the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, we want to make sure that people know that the impact just isn't on the animals, that it's about us too. We're a part of the problem, but we're also part of the solution. So for us, conservation and education is part of our mission. So we want to make sure that when visitors come through our doors, we're sharing the message that these animals are being impacted by what we're doing to the ocean, but that there's something we can do about it. So for us, we want to make sure that sharing that message inspires people to take it beyond the aquarium walls and to take it home and to do something that impacts our community in a positive way.
Bonnie Monteleone, there was a turtle that changed the direction, really, possibly the course of your life's work. Can you tell us about that turtle, Mae West?
I was taking a course at UNCW, so my background is actually in liberal studies, and one of the assigned readings was called Plastic Ocean by Susan Casey, and in it she had described this gentleman by the name of Charles Moore that just stumbled on this garbage patch area, started doing the research, and also in this article it described a turtle that crawled through a milk jug ring, of all things, when it was very small. Instead of her shell being able to break that plastics, it was actually forced to grow around it. And when I saw the image of this turtle, the snapping turtle, I knew that that was going to be my research area for my master's.
So how do we know at this point? So you've described the image of this turtle growing her shell, having to grow into a figure eight shape because of this ring that just didn't break around her. But what other animals, what other specific ways are we seeing the impact of plastics on animals? Which animals, and how is it impacting them?
Well, sadly, we're finding out that it's all the way through food web. So we're talking all the way from plankton up to the largest marine animals on the planet, which are blue whales.
How does plastic hurt a blue whale?
Oh, sadly, it doesn't take much. Research done at UNCW determined just the top of a piece of a CD case took out a 42-ton whale. So unfortunately, it swallowed this item, and then it poked or created damage through the esophagus and ended up being the demise of the animal. So it doesn't take much plastic to take out very large animals.
What are some other animals, Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, that people might relate to that are impacted by plastics?
Well, humans has to be a big one, especially in our coastal community. We eat a lot of fish, and fish are eating these little pieces of plastic. So new research is showing that the fish are eating the plastic, and then we're eating the fish. So I don't think we can take humans out of that animal realm, because we are a part of the environment, and we're consuming it as well. But those fish definitely are eating those little tiny pieces of plastic as it breaks down. I don't think there's really any animal out there that's not impacted by this that lives in the ocean. We have filter feeders. And like Bonnie was saying, we have those little plankton that are taking in and absorbing everything around their environment. So it's not only about the pieces of the plastic, but as they break down and they release those chemicals, all of that's going into their bodies as well. So if an animal lives in the ocean, it's very likely that it's going to be impacted by plastic.
So you're saying that you're finding plastic components in plankton, Bonnie Monteleone. How are you finding this?
So research that I'm doing with Suzanne Brander and Allison Taylor at the college, we were able to actually expose some very small pieces of plastic to plankton. And then we video recorded these plankton actually selectively ingesting these plastic pieces. So we know for a fact that they do and will take advantage of the pieces that are floating around them. We then took it to the next level and fed these plankton to larval fish. And so now we're able to actually look at those chemicals that will be migrating up the food web.
And we'll get to this a bit later in the program about some local exhibit going on that showcases a lot of this through art and also just through informational exhibits. But albatross, how are albatross affected by this?
Albatross are amazing birds. They have over a 9-foot wingspan. They're just graceful, beautiful beings. I actually witnessed them in the North Pacific garbage area. And sadly, anything that floats to them for a millennium, right, meant food, right? And so they're interpreting these plastics as food. And lots of times they take them back to their chicks, and they're feeding these plastics to the juveniles.
They're feeding plastic to their babies.
Yeah.
Because they think that it's, and so what happens then to the baby? Is the baby able to poop it out, or what happens to the chick?
Not in most cases, because these items are very large, like bottle caps, lighters, pens, toothbrushes. And the thing with the older birds, they have a bolus, so they are able to spit it back out. But the small birds do not have that capability. So they end up ingesting these plastics, and then they set in their stomachs. They can't break them down. And so their stomachs then can't absorb nutrients, and they eventually die from starvation.
So you've talked about how components of plastic then get into plankton. So these have to be very tiny particles. But we hear in other sectors that it takes hundreds of years for plastic to decompose. So how long does it take for it to decompose? And why is it at this relatively early stage of the game in human history already getting into plankton? Can you bridge that gap?
Sure. So plastics don't biodegrade, they photodegrade. So when they're exposed to a lot of sunlight, they end up becoming very embrittled. The chemicals that make them flexible are actually removed, and then they break into smaller pieces. ocean and wave action will then break it into smaller pieces. And that's what's making them available to different size organisms. Now, what I brought to you today is a bucket full of plastic that I actually found on a beach in Hawaii. So this isn't in some developing nation. This is actually on our soil, right? And this plastic came from the Garbage Patch region, so it washed up on the beach. And what we're learning from all this plastic that's washing in is it's not just that it photodegrades, but there are bite marks in a lot of these pieces of plastic that we're finding. So therefore, animals are actually helping in the breakdown process and making them more available then to smaller species.
So what are we looking at? You said you brought this bucket of stuff that you found on the beach. And there's this plastic bin full of, it looks like, sand and different kinds of plastic particles. What do we have in this bin?
So as a graduate student at UNCW, one of the activities I participated in with Charles Moore was sailing from Hawaii to California, sailing through the Garbage Patch. That was our goal. So before we left, I went and looked at some of the beaches in Hawaii. And this particular beach was completely covered, up to 12 inches of these plastic particulates. And it was really when I was standing on the beach and looking at this entire beach covered with these plastics. By the way, there is no sand. This was a lava beach. So this is
nothing in this bin is sand.
Nothing of it is sand.
From where I sit, and I'm maybe 3 feet away, it looks like there's a bed of sand.
Right.
This is not sand. It's all plastic.
It's 90% plastic. There are some little bit of seeds and type things, but most, like 90% of it is plastic. And it really was when I saw a beach that looked like this in our own country that I realized, like, I couldn't just defend, right? I couldn't just say, you know, like, okay, this is a big problem and move on. I knew I was going to have to start a nonprofit.
Okay, and we're going to talk more about that nonprofit when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about how the plastics we use in our daily lives are finding their way into the ocean. We have two experts here today to answer your questions. We're opening the phone lines. Give us a call, 910-343-1138 or coastline at whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking about the impact of our use of plastics on oceans around the world. And here to answer your questions are Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino with the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher. She's the education curator. And Bonnie Monteleone, who works as the director of science, research, and academic partnerships for Plastic Ocean Project, Inc. She's also a researcher who has collected plastic marine samples globally. The phone lines are now open. If you have a question for either of our guests, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Before I get to our first email, Bonnie, just before we went to break, you referred to a nonprofit that you'd started because of the volume, just the sheer volume of the plastic that you'd found on some beaches. What is the nonprofit?
The nonprofit is Plastic Ocean Project, Inc., and it serves research, outreach through art, and education through collaboration.
And what is the mission of the nonprofit? What are you trying to do?
Well, I'd have to say it's beyond trying at this point. We have now worked with over 60 students at UNCW on different research projects. We have also taken our art exhibit across the country, and it's working its way back. We have also started some collaboration initiatives working with our local restaurants. So we have the ocean-friendly establishments, and that is to encourage restaurants to not just give out straws, but only give them out upon request. And we have many restaurants that now reach out to us saying they want to be a part of this initiative.
Wait a minute. What does the use of straws have to do with being ocean-friendly? Yeah. Why are we talking about that?
Really such a simple idea, right? There's so many of us that don't even use the straws, and they're set down before us, and then they end up in the trash. So it's just giving people the opportunity to reduce their use of plastic, just one item at a time, right? And then if people need to use straws, there are plenty of situations where people do, then fine. But I attribute it to like asking for the hot sauce, right? You just ask for a straw. It's not that hard.
So can you, Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, tell us about the trail from, let's say I go to get a lunch today, a takeout salad, and I get a plastic fork with that salad, and I eat my salad and then I toss the fork. What's the trail of the fork to the ocean?
Well, plastics come from fossil fuels. So when we look at plastic, that is starting at a process where we're mining in our environment for fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas, those types of things. As those things become plastic, they are a part of chemicals that are really part of that trail. So you use that plastic fork, it likely will end up in the trash because you used it, which is good. But it is likely that a bag might break, it could end up in the environment, and then also make its way, like Bonnie was saying, from any water source ends up in the ocean eventually. So it's important to know from start to finish where our plastic's coming from and where it's going to go at the end. So if we don't use it in the first place, that's less stress on our natural resources to even produce that plastic.
Bonnie Monteleone.
Yeah, I'd like to add, so here we are, we're using limited resources, right, like petroleum and natural gas. We're turning it into plastic that we use for a matter of moments, and then we discard it, and it persists in the environment anywhere from 400 to 1,000 years.
My plastic fork?
Yeah, so it's
so
not
sustainable. How long will that fork hang around in the environment? When is it gone?
The sad reality is, it's never gone because there's nothing that can break up these chemical compounds, right? So we created this chemical compound, and the planet hasn't quite figured out what to do with it. And that's why it persists for indefinitely.
So is there any way to just take all the plastic and pile it up in one corner of the world, and since it doesn't degrade, then it won't move? Or we're just talking about in all of our lifetimes, we've got piles of plastic that are still here.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, because it persists for so long, every piece of plastic that you've ever used, outside of the small fraction that has been burnt, is still on the planet somewhere. So when you think of each and every one of us, from those diapers, from those toys, right, on up through all the single-use items that we've used, we each have a pile of plastic somewhere.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about ocean plastic and why it's no longer a conversation about a few ugly garbage patches in the ocean. Here to answer your questions are Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, education curator at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, and Bonnie Monteleone. She works at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where she is a plastic marine debris research and lab assistant. She's also the director of science research and academic partnerships for Plastic Ocean Project, Inc. You can ask our guests a question today by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. And we have an email from Carol, who writes, "My question is based in the fact that some nations have big factory ships for processing whale meat, fish, and so forth. Are either of the guests aware of anyone exploring the idea of processing the contents of the plastic islands into usable products at sea, using tender ships to bring supplies for the crew and take away products? Is this even a reasonable concept for some of our local innovators to investigate?" Bonnie Monteleone.
I'd be glad to take that one. That's one of the first questions after I give a lecture is, you know, what are we doing about the problem out there and why aren't we cleaning it up? And the sad reality is it's in water, right? So it's barely breaking the surface, most of the plastic. Most of it's hanging in the water column. So we would have to destroy a lot of marine life in order to net all the plastic out, right? So that's one of the issues. The other is that it's, you know, energy intensive, right? So, you know, taking a ship across the ocean to collect plastic that literally has zero value, right? This stuff has a lot of biota growing on it, so it's not so much going to be recyclable. So those are the reasons why we haven't actually figured out a way to address it from that perspective.
We also have an email from Jack who writes, What can we do to persuade supermarket chains not to sell helium balloons in their coastal stores? Well, first of all, why do helium balloons matter? What's the issue with those? Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino.
The issue with balloons is they will come back down. So if you release a helium balloon, it is made of plastic. So there are parts of that balloon that are never going to break down into the environment. When you think of a balloon, even if it's rubber and not a Mylar balloon, the string is usually a plastic ribbon that's attached to it as well. We've had a sea turtle actually in our care at the aquarium poop out a balloon before. So anything that goes up must come down. So when you release a balloon, it's important to remember that that balloon is going to come down somewhere. And with 70% of our environment being water in the ocean, it's likely going to come down into the ocean and marine life is going to ingest it.
When you talk to groups at the aquarium, are they surprised to find out that what they thought was an innocent celebration where they're releasing a bunch of balloons into the sky to celebrate someone's life or wish someone happy birthday, that that actually has this kind of impact?
Yeah, I think people are surprised because it's an out of sight, out of mind issue. So when they release that balloon, they don't think about the second step of where that balloon's going to land. And it's really important to think about whatever we're using and whatever we're doing, that it's not just for that moment, that we're thinking about the long-term impacts of that balloon. We always suggest to people to do something that's going to have longevity, such as plant a tree, plant a garden, a memory bench, those types of things that are going to be used by your community and used for years to come instead of a one-time balloon release that will potentially harm wildlife.
You're listening to Coastline talking about ocean plastic and why it is now moving into the human food chain. We have Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino from the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher with us, and Bonnie Monteleone, who works at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where she's a plastic marine debris research and lab assistant. If you have a question, you can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Bonnie, getting back to this plastic bin, this is a plastic bin that you brought, by the way.
Yes, it is in plastic.
It's full of stuff that you found on a beach. Where?
That was in Camillo Beach, Hawaii.
In Hawaii. And from where I sit, just a few feet away, it looks like it's full of sand with some other debris in there and some larger plastic pieces. But you're saying it's not, there's no sand in this. It's all plastic particulate matter in one form or another. And there is a blue plastic. It looks like it might have been a shampoo bottle or something like that. Can you tell us what's on that bottle?
Well, actually, this is for this one?
No, the one that's in the bin.
Oh, the blue. Oh, okay, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. So what we have here are some plastics that have bite marks in them. And we see all different types of bite marks, right? So some can be easily identified as from a sea turtle, but other maybe sharks or other types of fish. So this was one of the research projects that we hope to address, is trying to find the bite signature so we can determine who are some of these marine organisms that are ingesting this plastic or helping break down this plastic into smaller pieces.
And so can you tell by the bite marks on that particular piece who might have left those marks there? Or
To be honest with you, I can't. And that's the other thing, right? It's going to take a lot of research to figure out what is exactly ingesting these plastics. So what a wonderful research project for a marine biology student. And that's exactly what I do. So I just bring back these samples from the over 10,000 nautical miles that I've traveled collecting samples. I bring them back so that students can do analysis on them. So that's one of the ones in progress. Also in front of me, I have samples from the North Pacific and the North Atlantic Gyre. As we had talked about the balloons, we actually find balloons in our surface samples, right? So thousands of miles away from land, and yet we're finding these balloons with their associated ribbons.
So we're looking at glass jars that are about 3/4 of the way full of water. This is ocean water, you said, from the Pacific?
One is from the Pacific, the other from the Atlantic. And that's just to show you that it isn't just happening in the garbage patch area. It's also happening in other regions. So the research that I've been doing on for 5 years in the North Atlantic proves that the same problem is happening globally.
Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, are we seeing it locally?
Yes, absolutely. If you go out to our beaches, you can see marine debris on our beaches at any time of the year. Our oceans are all connected. They are one big environment. So like Bonnie was saying before with the currents, just like our circulatory system, it's really important to know that whatever goes into the ocean can travel anywhere. We're connected to that coastal environment. So those particles and those pieces are in our waters as well.
And we have an email from Suzanne who writes, I believe turtles eat jellyfish and those things look similar to them when floating in the water. I think this is a question maybe around balloons.
Mm-hmm. It's actually probably about plastic bags.
Okay.
When you get a plastic bag in the environment and it's floating and filled with water, it very much looks like a jellyfish. Turtles have smaller brains, and so to them, when they're looking for their food source, they see something that looks like a jellyfish and they go right for it. So it's really important that it's not only balloons, but for sea turtles especially that eat those jellies, it's really important that we make sure that plastic bags don't end up in the environment because that's the first thing that they go to because it looks like their natural food source.
Okay, so what products are we talking about here? Bonnie Monteleone. So we've mentioned plastic utensils. We've talked about balloons. We've talked about those plastic bags that you get if you don't bring your own bags to the grocery store. What other products are issues? How broad is this?
Well, of course, water bottles, right? Different types of bottles. I mean, we use about 1,500 every second in this country alone. So when you think about that in volume over courses of years, something that doesn't go away, we're talking about a huge problem, especially because they float as long as the cap is on them. But once the cap deteriorates, it breaks, it ends up sinking, right? So we have no idea where these items are going in relation to the ocean, but we know that they're ending up out there. So that's another huge problem that we can avoid by just using reusable beverage bottles.
And are there plastic products winding up on, say, beaches that rely on tourism? I mean, certainly that's true in our local area, but say Bermuda, those are beautiful beaches.
Yes, my experience in traveling around the world, especially islands inside these gyres, they just get pummeled with the trash that's ending up out there. So, you know, when you think about islands, they typically don't produce anything but have tourism, so they're using a lot of single-use plastics. Then they have a lot that's washing up on their beaches, and they have very little landfill space. So some islands actually resort to putting this plastic or their garbage on barges and taking it 200 miles offshore and dumping it. So this is why we really have to figure out a way to make this plastic valuable, give it some kind of connection where we don't just dump it, but actually find a purpose for it.
Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino.
I took a group of teens last summer to Costa Rica to study leatherback sea turtles, and we cleaned up the beach, this remote, beautiful beach. We cleaned up a very small piece of it and woke up in the morning and it was all back, and the kids were devastated because it wasn't us producing the trash, but it doesn't matter. We're all a part of the problem. We're all a part of the solution. And they told us about an area that was a couple of miles from where they were from, and the cleanup that they do each week, they actually schedule. It's so big and so such a problem that they actually schedule a type of trash that they collect that week. So that week they were collecting toothbrushes, so they go through and that's the trash that they pick up that week. So
there are enough toothbrushes washing up on beaches in Costa Rica that has its own day?
Day, yeah. And so then the next week they might do a flip-flop, like a plastic flip-flop sandals. And then the next week it might be styrofoam pieces. So it's a huge problem for these beaches that aren't inhabited because of the currents. It's just getting pushed up every day. Each morning it's there again, even though you clean it up that day before. So that was really eye-opening for the kids to be able to see that.
So how does this work from a hydrological standpoint? I don't even know if that's the right word, but the way the ocean currents move, whose plastic is washing up on the beaches of Costa Rica? Where are all these toothbrushes coming from?
Everywhere.
Yeah, so I would guess that our trash ends up in the UK, right? So when the tsunami hit, the trash that washed off of their shores ended up in Washington and California, right? So because it's these circular patterns, our trash always ends up in somebody else's yard, right? So that's exactly what's happening when you describe these toothbrushes. And believe it or not, when we sample in the ocean, we find toothbrushes in our surface samples. So they're another ubiquitous problem.
So Bonnie Monteleone, there's crossover in the work when it comes to researching ocean plastics from chemistry to different facets of marine biology. Can you talk about how those disciplines are involved with one another and your role in that, in the study of ocean plastics?
So I started this research in 2009, and being able to bring back these samples and students actually get to see them, that inspired students to approach me about how do I get involved in research. Well, I'm a non-scientist, but lucky for me, I work in the chemistry department at UNCW, and down below us is the biology department. So just starting conversations with our biologists and our chemists saying, I've got students that really want to do research. I have the plastic. How can we have them look for the persistent organic pollutants that attach to the plastics, or have them look at the chemicals that leach out of water bottles, or have them look at the different species that will ingest different types of plastic. So we are now expanding all different types of research, including some samples that we were doing on our very own Wrightsville Beach. So in 2011, we started a meter square sampling, much like I do in other parts of the world. And then in 2013, we started the smoking ban on Wrightsville Beach. So we had the preliminary data to actually prove that the smoking ban is working. And that's all from undergraduate research. So in other words, those cigarette butts are still the number one item we're finding on our beach. We actually proved that the ban is working.
Otherwise, so you're finding fewer butts on the beach.
Yes. And that's all student-driven research.
And how long does it take for a cigarette butt, by the way, to biodegrade? Yeah,
because it is also made of plastic, it can persist from 60 years to 400 years.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're learning about how plastics are showing up in our oceans, not just in isolated garbage patches anymore, how they're making their way into our food supply. And we have ocean plastic researcher Bonnie Monteleone from UNCW, as well as North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher's Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino. She's the education curator. After this 90-second break, we have the final segment. That's your last chance to ask a question, 910-343-1138 or Coastline at WHQR.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a conversation with a couple of experts about how plastic, a relatively modern invention, is showing up in our oceans, our marine mammals, our plankton, even our food. And here to answer your questions are Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, education curator at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, and Bonnie Monteleone, an ocean plastics researcher at UNCW, who's taken ocean samples from around the globe. You can ask our guests a question today by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. And Bonnie, just before we went to break, you were telling us about some of the research that is currently being done on this issue.
Yes, I also wanted to share with you a story about a student that reached out to me and wanted to know about BPA-free bottles. She was curious about what the chemical substitution was. So again, I'm a non-scientist, so I was able to connect the student with Dr. Pam Seaton, who's the chair of the chemistry department, and they were able to run some experiments on some BPA-free bottles. And sadly, even the control leached chemicals. So, and one of the chemicals that leached out was called acrylonitrile, which is a known carcinogen. So though we are, you know, being sold that this is better for you because it doesn't have BPA, we really do not know all the chemicals that leach out of those plastics. So it's just a way for us to be fully aware that whenever you're eating or drinking out of plastics, that there are chemicals that leach out.
So it really is perhaps just a marketing idea, this BPA-free plastic. We don't know if that has any meaning.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying in a practical sense. We have Eric from Shallotte. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have a two-part question. First, I've been told that it's possible to synthesize hemp oil into a plastic-like substance to replace plastic. And the second part would be, you know, if that's true, would those plastic replacements be biodegradable, and how can we push the government into allowing more research into industrial hemp?
Do we know anything, Bonnie Monteleone, about hemp oil synthesis?
I do know that you can make plastic or make a hemp oil into plastic. And I think the problem is even oil degrades, right? So it's the chemical compounds that we are adding to those oils that is making it indestructible. So that would have to be, you know, researched further, but I'm not too confident that it would actually dissolve or go away. It would be the same type of problem.
Eric, thank you so much for your call. And we also have Francisca from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm listening to the program, and it's fantastic, it's sadly enough, to hear everything. I only want to mention, I think last week or 14 days ago, Expo 216 is opened on North Front Street. It's a museum gallery. And there you can see the way you talked about the circles in the ocean, the trash.
The gyres.
Yes. And the arts are involved, and it is a magnificent exposition and building, and it really, really tells you a lot about the plastics.
It does. And Francisca, thank you so much for that perfect segue into Expo 216, because we are going to talk about it now. Thank you so much for your call, Francisca. Appreciate it. There is this exhibition just down the street, as Francisca just told us. It just opened up, 216 North Front Street, New Museum, Expo 216. Its entire space right now is dedicated to raising awareness about the impact of plastics on the Earth's oceans. The museum boasts this really wonderful combination. I just encourage everyone to get down there and check it out. It is worth seeing. It's a combination of informational exhibits, art made from plastics, and Bonnie Monteleone. What else do you do? Oh, you're an artist too. You created this incredible artwork based on interpretations of the work of Japanese artist Katsushita Hokusai. Can you tell us about this work?
I'd be glad to. So after I defended the research that I had done for my master's, one of the questions was, Bonnie, what are you going to do with all this plastic trash that you've collected around the world? And I just off the cuff said, I don't know, maybe I'll turn it into an art exhibit. And sure enough, that's what I ended up doing. And it's now 25 feet of canvases storyboarding the research that I've done, the plastics that we found, and why it's significant. And why I chose Hokusai's work was because it was actually block art that was done in the early 1800s. And so when you look at the exhibit, when you get to that last piece of art, it looks nothing like the first.
And you're talking about an image that many people have probably seen.
Yes.
They may not know what we're talking about, but can you describe it?
Sure. So it's a Japanese artist, and it's of a giant tsunami-sized wave and with Mount Fuji in the background. And the reason why I chose it actually was because it is most recognized, but also for the fact that in less than 200 years, we have actually changed the chemistry of the ocean, at least with the plastics and, of course, other man-made compounds that are floating around in our oceans. So it's to bring awareness that in a very short period of time, we have done a lot of damage. But that's not to say that it's game over, because though plastic is one of the environmental issues of our day, it is probably the easiest one to fix. So it's not going to be easy, but I think if we bring a lot of awareness to this, we can all get involved. I mean, you can't pluck mercury out of the ocean, but you can pluck plastic, and we can all participate in this and actually make the situation much better.
So I'm going to ask you in just a few minutes about some of those specific things that we can all do, small changes we can make in our own lives that could make a difference. But right now we have Jerry from Wrightsville Beach. Welcome to Coastline, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi, my name's Jerry. I live on a sailboat that's been traveling from Alaska to South America 10 years on the Pacific side and 10 years on the Atlantic side, and I've seen many, many countries where the smaller towns all throw their garbage in the river, and it all ends up back on the beaches. Now, 30 years ago, packaging was probably more organic, but now it's all plastic. So all that stuff comes back on the beaches, and I've been on many, many islands where it's a foot deep in plastic on the beaches. And I'm just wondering if your guests have any idea how to deal with that problem.
Bonnie, thanks so much for your call, Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry, thank you so much for bringing awareness, because this is a huge problem, especially for our island nations. And just recognizing the fact that, you know, our plastic production goes up about 8% annually, and yet our recycling rates remain to be around 8 to 10%. So we have to come up with a solution, and that's why at UNCW, one of the things that, again, our students are working on are how can we take plastic and turn it back into oil? Because if we give it that kind of value, a product that we go to war over, there's a better chance that we're going to value it enough to not let it end up in places it doesn't belong. And so, especially for these island nations, right, they have to have petroleum brought into their islands to fuel their cars. So there's a carbon footprint for that. They have all this plastic that's washing in, and they're using a lot of plastics for their resorts. So how about we figure out how to turn plastic back into oil so that we're giving it value? It doesn't have to go in the landfill, and it'll actually encourage people to want to clean up the plastic because it has great value.
Just this week, scientists announced the extinction of a tiny mammal known as the Bramble K. malomus. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, or the mosaic-tailed rat. This little guy was known only to live on Bramble K, which is a portion of the Great Barrier Reef that's off the coast of Australia. And the extinction of this mammal is being characterized as the first known instance of climate change-induced or man-made induced extinction. Is there a link between the use of plastics and climate change? Bonnie?
Other than the fact that it takes an enormous amount of energy to go and get the oil out of the ground, right? So we have now, we're offshore drilling. So that's releasing a lot of CO2 emissions. And then the transport of that oil to a facility that will then turn it into plastic pellets, that it'll then be transported to a place that will turn it into a plastic product, that then will be transported to a store for us to drive to the store to pick it up. So I would say, yes, that it is contributing to this problem of climate change. And just if we would reduce our use of plastic, we would be reducing all that transmission of CO2.
We spoke earlier about Expo 216, this new museum that's opened up that's designed to raise awareness about issues. Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, tell us about the aquarium's contribution to this current exhibition about ocean plastics.
We really wanted our contribution to be about solutions. So we were so excited to think about plastics in a way that can get our community involved, to get people really excited about this is a big issue, but let's do something about it together. So we did two different things. One is a photo that we staged, and in that photo you will see multiple items that are made of plastic. We took the exact same photo with the items switched out for reusable items, just to show that no matter where you are and what you're doing, whether it's reading the morning news and having your coffee or having a birthday party for one of your children, that there are ways that you can contribute to make sure that you're not contributing to the plastic issue. The other one is a chalkboard. Right as you leave Expo 216, it says, "What can you do?" We really want people to go through this exhibit and think about their part in it. We don't want people to come away thinking that it's a separate issue that somebody else has to deal with. This is something we all have to deal with. And that chalkboard has been so neat to see the ideas that people are coming up with that are being put out there to contribute to making a difference for not only our community, but for the world as well.
What are some of the ideas that you've been seeing?
When I was there over the weekend, I definitely saw all the ones we've been mentioning. Don't use the plastic bags. Don't don't use your straws. Take your could-go containers when you go out to eat. Don't use plastic when you are taking your leftover food. All of those things are really great. It's also reached the level of making sure that you spread the word. So contacting people that can do something about this. Is there laws that we can put into effect? Are there things that we can do that our community can get involved to maybe say, let's not use plastic bags anymore. Let's not have smoking on the beach. What are these things that we know are going to make a difference and that can do it beyond the individual and more move towards doing it as a community?
So what are some of the legislative changes or public policy changes that we might be able to make? Are there things at the state level we should be talking about? Bonnie Monteleone.
So there are plenty of states that have banned the bag, and even, you know, Hatteras has banned the bag. So that's one way that we can legislate. Also just charging a fee, you know, 5 cents, 20 cents for a plastic bag. And that actually works very well in other countries like South Africa, where they have completely cleaned up the environment of plastic bags just by charging a fee for those bags. They actually said that it used to be called their national flower because there were so many plastic bags on everything. I mean, when you think about South Africa, it's extremely windy. So those bags would get picked up and, you know, parked in trees and bushes and fences. And legislation does help in those situations.
And this is something, I mean, South Africa has been aware of this for a few decades, haven't they? This is not a new issue for them.
None at all.
Are we running a little bit behind some other nations on that front?
We do, and it's partly because we have these lobby groups that are very powerful in preventing such things being implemented in our legislation. But we also have things like Surfrider. Surfrider is a huge advocate for coming up with ideas and working with the community in order to get people on board to ban the bag or come up with a fee.
At Expo 216, there are also some video clips available of marine life. And there's one that shows some people rescuing a humpbacked whale. Do you know what I'm talking about? Bonnie, can you sort of tell this story, what people might see if they go there?
It's so worth, even if you just see this video, it's spectacular. And I know the gentleman that actually helped disentangle the whale. His name is Michael Fischbach. And he was out offshore.
Well, that's appropriate.
Yeah, how appropriate is that name, right? Beats Monteleone. Anyway.
So
they stumbled upon this whale that was completely encased in ghost gear. And ghost gear are these huge plastic nets that used to be made out of hemp and cotton, which would eventually dissolve. They're made out of plastics, and plastics in the ocean will persist much longer. And so this animal was about give out, as my southern friend would say, because it was so encased in this particular plastic netting. And they were able to cut the net off. It took them several hours. But once they freed that whale, it breached something like 40 times, just jumping for joy that it was free. Such a beautiful video.
You worked on a plastic ocean documentary?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
So this is what's been exciting about my life. You know, I got curious about plastics in the ocean, something that, you know, I don't have a background in. I had to learn a lot in a very short period of time. But through pushing myself outside of my comfort zone, and I say this for young people, I was able to get involved in a lot of different research projects. And it also included working with Joe Ruxton, who is the producer of A Plastic Ocean. It's a major motion picture that's going to be coming out this year. And it's quite exciting. There's a lot of different research areas that she explored with this film, and I'm lucky enough to be in it.
And when does it come out?
The date hasn't been set yet.
Okay, you'll let us know about that.
I will for sure.
All right, and we'll put all of this information on our website as well. So before we end, quickly, what are one or two things that everyone should be doing, simple changes that people can make in their lives right now? Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino.
I would say get rid of those disposable plastics. Anything that's reusable, let's use something that's going to be used over and over again. And then when you do that, keep spreading the word. Tell people, get the message out there that you're doing this and that they should do it too.
That's this edition of Coastline. Bonnie Monteleone, Jennifer Metzler-Fiorino, it's been a pleasure having you both today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You can now hear Coastline twice a week, Wednesdays and Thursdays at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Today's producer is Claudia Thompson. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Aurora Shimshak engineered today's show. If you missed part of it, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.